Okay, any questions about dealing with stress and adjustment disorders before we move on?
Yeah.
Great, hopefully that's because I've been clear. Two announcements I forgot to include in the announcements at the beginning. One is that Barb and I will be gone without much internet access for the first 3 weeks in February, so we'll have a stretch there where there will be a time lag in responding to emails, Google Group, etc. We take vacations sometimes. If you have any colleagues who are interested in the program and wish they'd had the sense to sign up when you did, we have a distance education session starting in March, so they can go ahead and sign up for that if they're cool with distance ed. If they want face-to-face, they'll have to wait till next October. If anybody wants details, they can find it on our website, or they can email me, and I'll be happy to send them all the info they need. Okay, now we're going to have some consultation time. And remember, the model we're using is not a 45-minute case presentation and 2 minutes for discussion, but rather a very brief presentation of who the client is, where you're at in therapy, et cetera, and then a bunch of time, trying to help you get what you want to get out of the consultation. Who has a case in mind for consultation? Some people volunteered last time. We also may well have room for some additional people to slip in. So we need some people who have clients.
I volunteered, so.
Great. Anybody else?
So I was one of the volunteers, but somebody wanted, offered.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, was that you?
Okay. Yeah, thank
so you.
So you
are doing it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So, let's start with you.
So, my client is I think he's a 40-year-old single gentleman and employed, and he came to me complaining of initially multiple panic attacks at work. But then I proceeded to learn in a really short amount of time about 100 different things about his life that were also stressors. And then it actually took a while, but it turns out that the real reason he was coming to see me was because of a relationship issue. But the challenge for me was, and this was before I started taking this course, and this client I was seeing on as part of a part-time job. So my full-time job, I have clients, but I don't do one-on-one therapy with them. So this was kind of new for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I just felt this barrage of information, and I was just like, I don't even know where to begin. Because, he was telling me, he had stressors from the get-go in his life. He was like an abandoned child. He was sent to live with his grandparents. He was introduced to drugs at like age 9. Everybody in his family did drugs or they drank. He became a cocaine addict, a cocaine dealer. He spent time in prison. So there are all these really complicated family issues that he was dealing with. He had a relationship with a woman. They had a child together. The child died when she was really young in a car accident. And then he's in a new relationship with a woman. He's living with her. She has a child. It's not his child, but he decides that, he wants to, step up and be the man that he couldn't be in the last relationship. But the relationship is splintering. They're both moving out of the house, and he's trying to keep everything together. And he's also got like a he's got a significant problem in managing his temper at work and with his relationship. So I just didn't know even where mm-hmm. to begin with this guy.
Yeah.
I mean, I actually did know because, when he told me about the panic attacks, and I was like, plus that he was a severe cocaine addict. And I said, have you seen a doctor recently? So my first goal there was like, you need to go to see mm-hmm. a doctor and see what's going
yeah.
on. And then the second thing was, and this kind of came a little later, because you know, the more he talked to me about it, the more I thought, you know, you need to go with your girlfriend to a therapist, a couple's therapist. You know, I wasn't trying to get rid of him, but I'm just thinking, this is like out of my, you know, realm of expertise.
Yeah. Let me just cut in, because I think that gives us a good
That's basically the story.
What do you want to get out of the consultation?
Well, here's the thing. He stopped coming to see me. So, but I guess when you first asked us to bring a case, I was like, I'll bring this one because I just didn't know what to do at first. I just felt overwhelmed.
Yeah, so it sounds like, what the heck do I do when there's this overwhelming mix of problems? What information would people like? What questions do you have before we get into how to deal with this situation?
About this case?
Yeah.
What information I would like from him?
Yeah.
I want to know what was the goal of the client.
Well, he had a couple of goals. He wanted to improve his... He wanted to salvage and save the relationship he had with his girlfriend. But it was kind of interesting because they were going their separate ways in a way because they were both moving out of their residence that they shared into separate residences. But he also had an objective of, you know, he said, I want to be a better person. I don't want to be a dickhead anymore. Because he knew that... This is why I really liked the guy, because he just had this insight into his own behavior that he wasn't, you know, I'm not nice to people. I have a temper. I explode. In my relationship, I intimidate my girlfriend because I can be, you know, I can be scary. And he totally denied ever hurting, you know, no physical, but he said there's emotional abuse, and he was aware of it.
So, I mean, I think there's a clarification needed. What is that a person mean, right? From the client. What else? Is there any other? You said he had a lot of goals. So those were
some of the key goals that he came with.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. What other questions should people have?
I would want to know about his cocaine use. How much he's using, how often.
So the cocaine he had stopped using years ago. But he also said that he was a regular user of marijuana, in fact, nightly. And he explained it to me, which I thought was kind of interesting. He said, you know, in the same way that some person might come home from work and have a glass of wine, I come home and I smoke dope. So, but he also, at the same time, he was kind of describing it as not problematic. He also, I sensed the more I talked to him that he did think maybe I shouldn't be smoking every night. So, but cocaine was in the past from what he was telling me. So it wasn't an issue in his current situation.
This connection between the loss of his son and him being abandoned. I'm just wondering if that came up. Did you talk about?
His daughter got killed in a car accident. No, Well, the other challenge with this guy is he could he kind of had a commanding presence and he was interesting at the same time. Mm-hmm. So it was like at this, you know, on the one hand I'm like he's giving me so much information here, but on the other I was like this guy has a totally interesting life. So sometimes I forget to just like, okay, you got to slow down. We got to, you know, we have to back up here and
And in terms of figuring out how do I want to deal with this complex situation, we're probably not going to explore his history of abandonment and the kid's death and so on at that stage. We're going to, you know, look into that when we're working on goals that it's relevant to. Now, one question would be, are there any issues about having been abandoned or, you know, having your daughter die that, you know, are important for us to deal with here? And I don't know what his answer to that question would be.
Yeah.
But also, wait, that's adding more onto the pile. Do I really want to add more to the pile?
I think another, with the addiction, I notice when they come in, there's more to it. If somebody has such a strong habit of such a strong drugs, right at the beginning what they tell you, usually it comes out to be they are much more than that. But of course until they're ready for it, they're not gonna admit to it. But they tell you a little bit. Like they will tell you something like much more milder, much more calm, start from there.
Yeah, but I mean, I deal with a lot of my clients in my daily job are drug addicts, and I come to learn that most of them are pathological liars. But this guy was holding down, so he could have been lying about everything, but he was holding down a job. He actually was a manager at a place. So he went to work every day, and I think if he was really using crack, you know, the way he used to, I just don't know that he would hold it all together. I don't know that he would be coming, like, proactively to seek therapy if he was, you know, still doing crack.
Yeah. So. And so when somebody comes in with a complex history, multiple problems, many complaints, etc., how do we decide what to do, how to deal with this situation? Ideas?
One question that I always ask is, so what is one of your major concerns?
Mm-hmm.
Where do we want to focus at? Because that's a lot, and I want to see what he want to focus on.
Mm-hmm.
And once I find that information out, then we start elaborating on that. Why is it so important for him to focus on that?
Mm-hmm.
What do you want out of that?
Yeah, and certainly finding out what the client's preference is a useful and valuable. You know, we're going to try to work collaboratively with this person, knowing what they want. Now, if we find out what their concern is, that's different than what their goal is. So if his main concern is the relationship, then I'd want to find out what goals does he want to work towards. Imagine we work together for a while and we're wonderfully successful. How would he like things to be different in that area? And it sounds like he wants to be a nicer person. He wants to handle his anger without exploding. He wants to deal with his girlfriend without intimidating her. And then switching from complaints and concerns to what the person want to accomplish is real useful. You know, sometimes people come in with just a mindset of, I want this problem to go away. And that's much less useful. That doesn't tell us what direction to go. You know, if somebody says, I don't want to be here, okay, do you drive north, south, east, or west? You know, if you want to be in Columbus, that tells you which direction to drive. If you say, I don't want to be in Cleveland, that doesn't tell you which direction to drive. So one of the reasons to shift from complaints and concerns to goals is it helps us be a lot more directive. But it's also, particularly when things are complex, much more than just finding out what the client's preferences are. You know, at this point, he's saying he wants to try to save the relationship and be a better person. Sounds fine to me, but wait a minute. He came in complaining of panic attacks. Are the panic attacks unimportant, or does he also want to get rid of panic attacks? That would be a useful question. You know, we have this drug history, and we're not sure, or at least some of us are not sure, whether we believe that he is no longer using cocaine. Do I have the skill set to assess it and figure out whether he's using cocaine or not? And once we figure out, once the person wants out of therapy, does that mean I should be doing therapy with this person? If he wants to, handle his anger without explosions, treat people better, etc., do I know how to deal with that? It sounds like he might qualify for intermittent explosive disorder. Do I know how to deal with anger management problems? If so, working with him on that is a great idea. Suppose I don't know how to deal with intermittent explosive disorder. Then we got the question of, do I want to put in the time and energy to learn how, or do I want to refer him on to somebody who deals with this? You know, if it sounds like, to save the relationship, they need couples therapy, do I want to see about shifting from, he came in individually, do I want to see about converting it to couples therapy and work with the two of them? Well, do I know how to do couples therapy? Does it look like it's viable to switch, into couples mode when I've already started with him individually, or do I need to refer them on to somebody for couples therapy? And one of the things to keep in mind is, no matter how wonderful I am, I don't know everything. I don't treat everything, etc. And just because somebody calls me up does not automatically mean I should be providing treatment. Good concrete example, suppose somebody calls me up with a substance abuse problem wanting treatment. I do dual diagnosis. I don't do primary substance abuse. I work with people once their abuse is more or less under control, sometimes more, sometimes less, and the issues that relate to it. If somebody's coming in with a primary substance abuse problem, they should see our partner, Warren Salkin, who's a CCDC3, or they've changed their code letters. Anyway, he's a chemical dependency counselor and a psychologist and has a long history of dealing with chemical dependency problems. He's a much better match than I am. I refer them on to Warren. You know, if somebody comes in to me with a primary problem of eating disorders, that's not really my department. You know, Carol Leventhal works with eating disorders a lot more than I do. And one of the principles, it's an ethical principle for psychologists, and I suspect it's an ethical principle for all the other professions, is we need to stay within our areas of competence. So, you know, it's completely legit to put in the time and energy to quick learn how to help this person with something new. But I need to be honest with myself. Do I have the time and energy to be competent in this area fast enough to be useful to this client? Or do I need to refer this client on to somebody else?
You made me think of one other thing. This guy was, this is another interesting thing about him. He seemed like a man on a mission. Like, he was very focused. Like, I need to fix this problem quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And that was another thing that was kind of overwhelming. I'm like, you know, listening to all the things that he's, mm-hmm. you know, just from his personal history and the current history,
mm-hmm.
I'm like, I don't know if this is going to be solved in a short amount of time.
Yeah, and I need to be realistic about what I sign on to. You know, just saying, yeah, sure, when the goal seems impossible to me is not doing anybody a favor. You know, one of the case examples we'll get to when we're talking about borderline personality disorders, the client came in with this long laundry list of anxiety problems and depression problems and relationship problems and anger problems, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And when we talked over goals and priorities, her, you know, number one goal was, I want my anxiety gone before we work on any issues, and no, I don't want to take any medications, thank you. Okay, am I going to sign on to that? You know, I don't know any way to do that. You know, I know great ways to resolve her anxiety problems by working on them. You know, it's quite possible that medication could be useful. But if the idea is, I just want my anxiety to go away before we work on anything, no, that's not something I can sign on to. And so, you know, agreeing on goals for therapy is, I'm not there as a short order cook. I'm there as a professional, you know, and both I get input, you know, if I've got reason to believe he's abusing cocaine and having panic attacks. The odds are real good that in order to treat his panic attacks effectively, he's going to need to be off the cocaine first. You know, and, you know, I'm going to need to negotiate that with him. You know, and if we can't agree on goals, then we're not in a position where we can work collaboratively. I'm real not likely to be effective with him if we can't agree on goals that are acceptable to both of us. And, you know, with somebody who has all of these many issues, another, you know, question to consider is, are we in a position where we can work in an open-ended way for as long as we need to and over time resolve all his issues? You know, completely legit option. But that only makes sense if he's got good insurance coverage and persistent motivation. You know, or do we need to pit some limited goals to work on? You know, particularly if somebody's only got 10 sessions, well, we need to choose goals that are plausible to work on in 10 sessions. You know, and, you know, a short-term time-limited format is completely legit. We can do CBT well in a time-limited format. An open-ended format is completely legit, too. You know, the practical realities make a difference. If I'm in a job setting where I only get to see people for 10 sessions, or if I'm working with a client who can only afford to see me for 10 sessions, we're going to need to make different choices than if we've got the option of working together indefinitely until we've accomplished what needs to be accomplished.
I noticed you didn't mention one of the things, the basic needs. because a lot of time, I'll give you two examples. Mm-hmm. I had a client coming to me, literally had no housing, couch to couch, mm-hmm. And then didn't lost a job, and all a lot of me had goal is to get a boyfriend, so everything was getting low.
Mm-hmm.
So right there, the basically. So anyway, one of the things a lot of time patients come in, they have no understanding of the basic need, and they want to solve the problem. But anyway, other example is I refer her to whatever she needed because she had too many basic needs. Another client that came in who was having a lot of issues, living with the mother, lot of issues, including anxiety and all that. Because this is, she had a housing permanent means with mom, but there are a lot of friction. While we are working on her anxiety, what I did, I also worked with her, finding a housing for herself because she had a job. Mm-hmm. She could do it, but because it's so much stress in her life, the concept of like, wow, I could go out and get out of this hell, it didn't occur
mm-hmm.
to her.
Yeah.
But I couldn't tell her in the beginning, you have to get out first, because mm-hmm. she needed to reach that stage.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like a lot of time basic needs, like the example, the client that he used, is that a lot of time when they have a lot of issues, sometimes basic needs.
Well, and the reason I didn't mention basic needs here is there was no indication that this particular client was having problems with basic needs.
Mm-hmm.
One of the ways to, if somebody's got many different problems, you know, one of the things we need to consider in prioritizing stuff is practical realities. You know, if, you know, with this guy's, you know, anger problems and his panic attacks, it sounds like all things being equal, those are lower on his priority list than salvaging his relationship with his girlfriend. That would be a reason to work on the relationship with the girlfriend first. However, if he's exploding at work and this is running the risk of him getting his butt fired, that would be a reason to move anger up on the list. You know, that if some of the, or if his panic attacks are keeping him from going into work and he's going to get fired, you know, we might need, for practical reasons, to address some of those issues early on. You know, a good example with my lady with the many problems, you know, who wanted her anxiety gone first, you know, once we negotiated that, you know, another thing on her list was she was deciding whether to have another kid, and she mentioned in practice that the way she was currently handling that was she had gone off birth control and was letting God handle that decision.
Oh.
Without mentioning it to her husband.
Oh.
Okay, this was going to blow up very soon. And, you know, so, you know, I raised that, you know, this is runs the risk of being a major problem in terms of our work together. We got two possibilities. One is we could move deciding whether to have another kid or not to the top of the list and deal with that right away. Perfectly fine option. Or she could go back on birth control. We could work on other higher priority things and get to whether to have another kid in a few months. You know, she chose to go back on birth control. That was fine with me. You know, it would have also been fine with me to start off by working on, is this a good way to handle how to decide whether to have another kid?
It's in belonging to, feeling the perception of belonging to someone is a basic need, though.
Well, I mean, you can debate what's a basic need and what isn't. You know, and I don't know, you know, a way to get a definitive answer on that. Certainly, many people desire a feeling of belonging. You know, in terms of deciding what to focus on in therapy, the question is, where does that fall among the priorities? You know, is the most important thing for the client to work towards a feeling of belonging, or do we need to deal with their, you know, angry explosions and their drug use and et cetera, you know, first, and get to that later in therapy? And in general, it makes sense to, first of all, start off with some things that are reasonably straightforward that we're likely to make noticeable progress on, you know, reasonably quickly. Because if we take something concrete and make headway on it, A, the person's getting some relief, but B, this gives them reason to believe that therapy is actually useful. If we start off with a therapy goal that's more vague and abstract, like having a sense of belongingness, completely legit thing to work towards, but we could spend a lot of time going around and around on that one without making noticeable headway, and it's really easy for people to get discouraged and give up. Now, if the top priority goal is vague and abstract, we can do our best to deal with that. But if there's some more concrete things to work towards at first, that often works much better. So we're not necessarily starting off with the most important issue. An example I use, and I'll probably end up repeating myself, if a person comes in with a history of childhood sexual abuse and a fear of freeway driving, which do I want to work on first? Well, I want to talk it over with the client and make a decision collaboratively. If we start off working on their history of childhood sexual abuse, we're going to get into deep, dark, complex emotional issues pretty quickly, and this doesn't give a lot of time to develop a trusting relationship and them to be feel comfortable opening up and so on. And it may well get too intense too quickly and just drive them out of therapy. This is not doing them a favor. The odds are freeway driving is much less of a big deal and less important, but it's something we can work on a pretty concrete level and have an excellent chance of getting noticeable improvement in a half dozen sessions. And this is going to be useful in the client's life. It's also going to give them some reason to believe that therapy can be useful. And it gives us some time to work on useful stuff while the person's getting comfortable with me and comfortable with openness and self-disclosure and so on. And so there are a lot of different things to consider in figuring out what we get to first. I want to take the client's priorities seriously. I want to start off on something concrete enough so we can make noticeable progress within a half dozen sessions. I want to be aware of practical realities so that practical stuff doesn't blow up in our faces and mess up therapy. And I also want to think conceptually, does it make any difference whatever we do things in? One thing we haven't talked about yet, but we're going to get to in the foreseeable future, if a person's got an anxiety problem and they're abusing a substance, we're not likely to treat their anxiety problem successfully while they're abusing the substance. In that case, we're going to need to either deal with the substance abuse first or deal with them simultaneously. There are plenty of other problems where the order doesn't matter. We can go with whatever order appeals to the client or whatever. Another completely legit approach is, of the many problems, which ones can I figure out what the heck to do about? If I start off working on problems I understand reasonably well, that gives me time to develop an understanding of the other problems. So lots of different factors to consider. How's all that sound?
I just Good. Have a question for you. You mentioned that he uses marijuana at night.
That's what he told me, yeah.
Does he talk about his behavior after he smokes the marijuana? Totally mellow. So wouldn't that be like, and I don't know from your experience, is marijuana addictive, just like cocaine? So isn't that also an element that when the effect of the marijuana wears off?
Well, it's because one of the issues with substance use is sorting out, is this a problem or not? The analogy the client made is some people have a glass of wine when they come home. I have smoke a joint when I come home.
Wait,
alcohol's potentially addictive too. If somebody comes home and has a glass of wine, is this a substance use problem we need to treat? Or is this a perfectly fine option we don't need to mess with? Well, it depends. Do they have a glass of wine or do they end up having a bottle of wine? What effect does it have in their life and so on? And so one of the many issues is, do I know how to assess and figure out whether this person has a substance abuse problem or not? In which case, I can do that.
Yeah.
If I don't know how to assess whether there's a substance use problem or not, I need to either learn how to do that or I need to refer them on to somebody who can make that assessment. Because if there's a substance abuse problem and we just ignore it, it's going to muck up dealing with the person's other problems. If we can sort out whether there's a substance use problem or not, then we then have a choice of, do we need to deal with the substance abuse problem first you know, or is it viable to deal with some other problems and then get to the substance abuse problem? Well,
couldn't we just bring up the idea or the notion that he needs to be more able to control his anger or his impulses rather than relying on the substance?
Well, certainly one of his goals is to handle his anger better. You know, so it's like we don't need to bring up that idea. He's coming to us with that idea.
Yeah.
But does that mean it's okay for him to smoke pot? Does that mean he has to give up pot today?
I mean, working out in a way that he will slowly, you know, taper himself from, if that is seen as an element that's even intensifying this vicious cycle of, you know, getting into anger and then...
Well, now, one part of that is, you know, developing more of an understanding of what's going on. At this point, I don't know if his pot use is aggravating his anger problems or is being helpful with his anger problems or is making no difference one way or the other. You know, pot generally doesn't aggravate anxiety problems. It generally mellows people out, and there's no shortage of people who use pot as a way to cope with anger or anxiety. It turns out not to be a very good option, but there are plenty of people who do that. Now, but that doesn't necessarily mean that this individual is reacting in the usual way. There certainly are no shortage of people who have unusual reactions to pot. You know, I can think of several clients I've had who've had panic attacks in response to pot. Wait, this guy's having panic attacks. You know, we're at some point we're going to want to understand when he has his panic attacks, you know, what the triggers are and so on. And, you know, if he freaks out each time he smokes pot, that's a good argument for, you know, backing off on the pot use. That's not the most likely scenario, but it's one of the possibilities. You know, so, you know, to figure, you know, we need a lot more detailed information to come up with, you know, that a definite list of priorities here. Let's move on to our second consultation case. You're on.
I don't know if this is a good one, but I'm going to do it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Young man comes to my office, should be 1 year old.
How old?
51.
51.
Was sexually abused when he was younger, sexually abused by his sibling. Parents found out about it, really didn't do anything about it because it was a religious issue. They really didn't know what to do. Went to psych ward, was treated, came out, went to several therapists. Over the years, he did end up getting married, was married for 23 years, still married for 23 years. Came to my office because he was very depressed, on the verge of losing his marriage, very confused about the image of being a man. Wasn't for sure what he wanted. And working with him and finding out some information, I found out that he's very manipulative. What he does is he has a very hard time, so he says he has a hard time solving problems. And what I found out working with him is not so much that he has a hard time solving problems. The problem is if he can't get his way, he's shut down and starts saying that he's depressed. So he goes into a shutdown mode and would not help his wife do anything, not make decisions. It was all up to her. So then he flips back to, I'm not a man, I can't make decisions. So it was a lot of things that was going on in his personal life. But like I said, his main goal was to deal with his depression and to look at how he could resolve his own issues.
Mm-hmm.
It just came into so much more.
So what would you like to get out of the consultation?
What I wanted to see him do is be realistic and be honest with himself.
Mm-hmm. So how do I get him to be realistic and honest?
Well, what I did was, and what I have been...
Well, I'm trying to... Is that what you want to get out of the consultation?
Yes.
Okay, great. So What other information would people like?
I have a question. Mm-hmm. Is it, just to clarify, is it like a masculinity issue, like I'm not a man, or is it like a gender identity?
Masculinity.
Okay. That's what I thought, what I was wondering.
Any ideas about how to get the guy to be realistic and honest?
But it was the abuse that brought him to you, or that was just the first thing that he really started talking about?
The abuse started when he was he's 50.
Right, and but...
what brought it, because he was depressed.
He was depressed, okay. So that just came up?
That just came up.
In the conversation. Mm-hmm. So and the abuse is one thing, and then this...
Depression,
but this also this issue of feeling like he's not assertive the way he should be in his relationships, or a little relationship with his wife, right?
What is his goal?
His to resolve his issue of depression, like just being able to deal with depression.
And so, you know, this again, I guess our thing today is issues around goal setting. You know, if the client wants to manage his depression, deal with his depression, and I want to get him to be realistic and honest, that's not a goal he's signed on to at this point. If I'm trying to get him to be realistic and honest, and what he's wanting is to manage his depression, this is going to be a big problem in terms of working. I'm going to be talking about stuff you don't want to talk about. And, you know, if I spend today's session and next week's session and the session after that trying to get him to be realistic and honest, is that going to poof make his depression go away? Not in the short, it might well be a great idea in the long run, but it's not going to get him out of his depression in the short run. And it's not unusual to have situations where the client comes in with one goal in mind, and the therapist is thinking, wait a minute, that's not what this person needs to accomplish. They need to accomplish this. And I need to figure out how to negotiate things so that we can, again, agree on what we're trying to accomplish so that we can work collaboratively. You know? Now, sometimes, you know, it's pretty simple and straightforward. You know, let's circle back to the example of somebody having panic attacks and abusing a substance, and they're saying, I want to get rid of my panic attacks, and I'm thinking, can't do that as long as they're abusing their substance. You know, one option I've got is I could say, makes perfect sense to me, dude, that you'd want to get rid of the panic attacks. You know, one thing I know from the research and from lots of experience is we're not likely to successfully deal with the panic attacks while you're doing cocaine. You know, if and got an excellent shot at getting rid of your panic attacks, but in order to do that, we're going to have to deal with the cocaine first. How's that sound to you? And if the client says, yeah, sure, let's work on cocaine first, I want to get rid of these panic attacks, no problem. Now, I may need to be a pretty decent salesman to pull that one off. But one completely legit option is the simple, straightforward, I see something that the client needs to work on, they don't see it, I, you know, persuade them. You know, another option is sometimes the client comes in saying, I want to work on X, Y, and Z, and they don't mention wanting to work on something that seems important to me. And a good starting point is that, gee, you haven't mentioned, you know, your panic attacks. Is that something you want to work on too? And they say, well, of course. You know, sometimes people don't mention important goals for therapy because it seems so obvious. It seems to go without saying. But I don't have ESP. I don't know if they haven't mentioned it because it's not important or if they haven't mentioned it because they don't want to work on it. Sometimes it turns out they didn't mention it because they're just assumed that I know they want to work on that. You know, and so, you know, simply clarifying sometimes is a solution. Now, there are plenty of times that are more complex than that. Back when Barb was running the phobia clinic at UH, one of her supervisees had a woman come in with a fear of freeway driving, and, you know, a few sessions into it, the therapist was having a heck of a time getting the person to follow through on their homework assignments. You know, so Barb checked out what were the goals of therapy, what were they working on, and so on. And the therapist was trying to address the woman's perfectionism. And the woman wanted to overcome her fear of freeway driving. And, okay, this was not working. The woman didn't want to follow through on homework. She saw her perfectionism as one of her good points, not as a problem. Now, usually perfectionism doesn't play an important role in fear of freeway driving. In this particular case, it turned out the therapist was right. The woman did need to work on her perfectionism. But since the client didn't see how working on perfectionism was relevant to freeway driving, there was no motivation to follow through on it. What the therapist needs to do is break it down into manageable steps and help the client see how her perfectionism plays a role in the freeway driving and why working on perfectionism is relevant, etc. And in this case, and a lot of them, focusing on particular times when freeway driving is an issue and identifying the feelings and pinpointing the thoughts, and then in this case, the perfectionism, you know, obviously played a role, and then it was possible to highlight how we need to work on this to get to where you can deal with freeway driving. And then the woman was motivated to work on it and follow through on assignments, and everything turned out just fine. You know, so we've got training in this. The client does it. Sometimes stuff is obvious to us that isn't obvious to the client. So it's part of helping the client see the connections.
And so did you say that one of the issues was when he has conflicts, he shuts down, that gets him depressed?
Well, he shuts down and he says he's depressed.
Says he's depressed.
Yeah, which is not necessarily the same as actually being depressed.
One thing I did know that I did usually, I use a lot of visual aid, so I have a bulletin board in my office. And one thing I did tell him, when I write stuff down and let people see what I'm saying and what they're saying to me, it seems to connect better as opposed to you sit down and you're talking to them. So when I was able to write things down, attitude changes and body language, and I focus in on that.
Yeah.
So I noticed that when I start writing things down and seeing what he was saying, all of a sudden,
Yeah, and one thing to keep in mind is we need to communicate effectively if we want therapy to work. And it varies from person to person what gets the message across. You know, visual aids of one sort or another can be really useful. You know, there are a lot of cognitive behavioral therapists who have a whiteboard in their office and they'll draw three columns and write stuff out, you know, or use a big sheet of poster board, or you know, I advocated writing it in your notes and then showing it to the person. Or you can use the forms from Mind Over Mood. You can draw a diagram. There's lots of different ways. And particularly once I get to know somebody and have a sense, if this is a person who's a visual learner, using imagery and visualizing stuff may get the message across much better than using abstract logic. For most people, you know, behavioral experiments are a lot more powerful than abstract reasoning. And so, you know, one piece of it is communicating effectively. And in this case, let's actually try this out a little bit. You'll role play him, I'll try being a therapist, and I'll try out one particular approach to intervening. What name should we use? It need not be his name.
John.
Okay. So, John, your top priority is dealing with the press. Just as a quick aside, clarifying a little more about what he's got in mind in terms of managing depression, you know, would be really useful, but that's not what we're doing at the moment. So your top priority is dealing with depression. You know, it's a whole lot easier to get a handle on this stuff if we take concrete examples one at a time and walk through it rather than talking in the abstract. Can you think of a good example of a time recently when depression was a problem for you?
Well, I was at work, and I had some work to do, and the boss didn't give me enough time to get it done, and I asked for extra time, and I really got upset about it, because the boss couldn't give me enough time to get it done, and I wasn't able to get it done, and I just got really depressed, and just started writing down anything, because I just couldn't get everything completed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that sounds like a great example. You know, when did this happen?
That happened about 2 weeks ago.
Okay. And so you're at work, you got a bunch of stuff to do, the boss is not giving you enough time. You mentioned feeling upset. You know, when you say upset, what feelings do you have in mind? What were your immediate feelings when it became clear to you the boss wasn't going to give you enough time?
He don't care.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now that sounds like a thought rather than a feeling, but that sounds like an important one. He don't care.
Scared. Feeling incompetent.
Mm-hmm. So feeling like upset, scared, incompetent. From the tone as you talked about it, it sounds like there was some anger there too. Were you angry?
Yes.
Okay, anger. So you're feeling upset, scared, incompetent, angry. Does that cover it, or were there other important feelings?
That's the main ones.
And one thought that ran through your head was, he don't care.
No.
Do you remember other thoughts?
He always wants things done his way.
Mm-hmm.
He don't think about his dad. It's always snap, snap, snap.
Okay, hold on a minute. Let me catch up with you. So he don't care, he wants things done his ways, he don't think about the staff, always snap, snap, snap. Does that pretty much capture it?
Yes.
And when you're thinking, he don't care, he want things done his way, he don't think about his staff, makes a lot of sense that you're feeling, you know, angry. You know, sounds like a pretty aggravating situation. You mentioned feeling scared. Were there any thoughts that went along with the feeling of being scared?
Well, see, my previous job, I got fired because my paperwork wasn't always accurate.
Yeah.
And I don't like doing paperwork.
So that makes it sound like there might have been some thoughts along the lines of, I'm going to get fired. Does that ring a bell for you?
Well, I do a good job, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that sounds like that ties into the feeling scared. You also mentioned feeling incompetent. And is incompetent an emotion, or is that an opinion about yourself?
At that time, I felt like it was emotion.
Yeah. And certainly, there's an emotion people feel when they think they're incompetent. But it sounds like despite your good work record, it sounds like at the moment you were thinking something about being incompetent. Do you remember what the thoughts were going through your head?
I don't remember.
Yeah. I mean, we don't know for sure. We'll clarify this more as we go, but it sounds like it was something along the lines of, if I can't do this as fast as he wants, I'm incompetent. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
That makes sense.
Yeah. And we'll get to that some more in the future. And so, you know, you were feeling upset, scared, incompetent, angry. You had all these thoughts running through your head. What did you end up doing that day? Well, you said you just wrote down all sorts of crap to get it done quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Does that cover it, or were there other things you did?
No, I did everything as fast as I could.
Mm-hmm.
And then I turned it in. And I was angry again.
Mm-hmm. And do it as fast as possible, just turn it in. You ended up feeling angry. Now, also, you know, we got to this by asking about a situation where depression was a problem for you. Where did depression come on the scene that day?
After it was done.
After it was done, then you were feeling depressed.
Yes.
And once you started feeling depressed, do you remember what was running through your head then?
I can remember just wanting to go to the bathroom and cry.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, on this occasion, it sounds like there was anger first. You were faced by a situation you didn't feel like you could deal with successfully. You dealt with it as best you could and ended up feeling angry and depressed afterwards. Mm-hmm. You know, is that pretty typical for you?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. And the times when you focus on feeling depressed, you know, at those times, are you usually also aware of the anger, or?
No, but I feel like I need to get that person.
Yeah, so it sounds like there's anger there, and you're not necessarily aware of it. And the times when you end up talking with somebody about the situation, like with your boss, you probably didn't sit down and discuss it with him. But like when you have a run-in with your girlfriend, do you end up just talking about, do you end up talking about how, what you're angry about, or do you end up focusing on how depressed you feel?
Well, she don't want to hear what you said, complain too much.
Now, does she say that when you're talking about how depressed you feel, or when you talk about feeling angry, or when you talk about anything? What's?
Well, she said I talk about my job too much. So she don't want to hear.
So she doesn't want to hear you complain about your job.
Tell me to get a new job.
Well, and you know, one way we could go with that is, what do you think of that idea? And so, you know, let's, you know, breaking out of the role play. You know, one part of getting people to be realistic and honest is helping them recognize what's going on. And often when it seems like a person's not being honest, it's really, they're not being dishonest, they're being unaware. And so taking specific situations one at a time and pinpointing the dots and tunes is real useful on that problem. Now, another part of it is looking at how the person deals with the situation. You know, we don't know how it would turn out with this guy when we work on him longer, but there's no shortage of people in the world who are reluctant to acknowledge certain feelings. You know, and if this person, it turns out this person is, you know, not willing to acknowledge being angry, and when they're angry, they talk about being depressed, or they try using it for leverage, you know, then we got a different situation than if we're dealing with somebody who's willing and able to talk about, you know, their anger. Now, we got another dimension here is, you know, if I'm completely in touch with myself and reasonable and communicate clearly and honestly, does this guarantee that my partner is going to respond reasonably? No. You know. And so, you know, one of the many questions is, you know, for the relationship part of this, is this something we can handle in individual therapy, or do I need to see about getting them into couple therapy at some point down the road? And, you know, another level to, you know, if it seems to me the person needs to be more honest, is paying attention, wait a minute, if this person is honest in real life, is this going to turn out to be a good, bad, or mediocre idea? You know, if he says to his girlfriend, I'm really pissed at you nagging me about the laundry, I'm not helping with the laundry today, is this going to be a good, bad, or mediocre idea? You know, and it may, in some relationships, it takes some work to get to the point where honesty is a good idea. And I'm not going to get somebody to be honest if being honest is stupid. You know, in order to get somebody to be honest, we need to get to the point where being, you know, communicating openly and honestly is actually going to turn out well. And there's no shortage of relationships where it's going to take some couple therapy to get to that point. How's all this sound?
Sound good.
Yeah. Now, last idea I want to throw in the hopper, and I almost lost track of, is if there's a goal I've got in mind that seems like the person should work towards, but if they're not in touch with it, they don't want to work on that. The final option is we could work on what they want to work on.
Right.
And as we work on it, we've got two positive goals. One is we might succeed and accomplish what they want to accomplish. This is not bad. And there's nothing that says I have to perfect the person. If we work on some of their issues that they want to work on and we're successful, and there are other issues they don't want to work on and we don't work on them, that's completely legit. Grown-ups get to choose what to work on and what not to work on. Maybe they'll work on it at some point in the future. The other way it can play out is as we work on the goal they want to work on, maybe the other issues will end up being an impediment. Perfectionism is a good example. A lot of perfectionists see it as a good point, not a problem to work on, and don't want to work on it. And if we're working on their depression, say, and as we work on it, it turns out they feel like a failure because they got really high standards for themselves and they, you know, keep falling short, then in my great wisdom it says, well, gee, it sounds like part of the reason you're so depressed is you've got standards you can't live up to. Does that make sense to you? You know? Sounds like maybe it would be useful for us to take a look at the standards you got for yourself as part of working on your depression. And now we're at a point where it makes sense to them to work on their perfectionism because their perfectionism gets in the way of overcoming their depression. And, you know, particularly if I can get to that point in a concrete example from a specific situation we're working on, that's going to make a lot more sense to them than if it's an abstract concept I, you know, just, you know, introduce in words. And so, you know, the times when some of their issues are an impediment to accomplishing what they want to accomplish gives us a great opportunity to get established that this is another thing we need to work on in order to accomplish what they want to accomplish. How's that sound? Okay, let's switch gears to your client.
She's 22, Caucasian. When she came, her goal for therapy was to help her cope with the hallucinations. She said she was diagnosed as functioning autistic person, ADHD, bipolar, and but she thinks that she's schizophrenic because of the hallucination part. So her main concern is to get skills on coping with those hallucinations. She gets audio and visual hallucinations. Constantly she's taking her meds. In the beginning, she said she was taking them right on time, the right dosage. And she needs help with that. Later on, she started mentioning from time to time that she's transgender and that she has, she don't know how to cope with that either and those feelings. But, so the main thing she came for, she said, well, maybe later on we can work on that. So when I did not know how to use CBT with the hallucination part. So I mentioned it later in the group, after I was already did some work by myself. What I was able to help her with is coming up with ideas, because I discussed exactly what happens to her. Does she has a feeling that she's going to get into that hallucination before that, and what type of hallucination she was going through. So she, one example, she mentioned that she will go, like, she's volunteering in a Meals and Wheels, and recently what happened is that there was a hallway, so she was walking. She was going through a hallucination. She found out later because she hit the wall on her face like that. She didn't. That was so scary to her because she saw that it was a hallway, but it was actually there was a wall there before turning to the hallway. Other examples is the audio is that she before sleeping. She will hear a loud siren and hear someone talking to her really clearly, not as before. It was just like gibberish she could understand, but now it starts to be really scary because it feels real. But in the morning, she will wake up and then she feels better that, like, oh, yeah, that was just me. That was just me hallucinating. So those are the two examples that that I remember now. So the one thing I, you know, I was after searching and stuff, I was thinking about maybe giving her anything that can make her senses a little more active, might help. So for that when she volunteered, I was suggesting that why can't she take a video of the whole area so that at home she can, like in her mind, trace it. Like, yeah, there's a hallway this way and this, you know, as a first step. And then to try to have, like, some candy in her purse, like strong mint or something. And when she feels that she's about to get that, then she can take the mint and, you know. So it turned out that those things worked. So she's becoming more relieved. And even with the rubber band, using a rubber band and maybe, you know, like snapping it a little bit. So she was having night terrors. I suggested, you know, after searching in the internet, well, can you just get up and wash your face with cold water and see if it's going to work? She did it. It works. So those night terrors,
what would you like to get out of the consultation?
Okay. What I wanted to get out of the consultation. So I managed to do that, but I really want to know how can I use CBT in that.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing that I wanted to get out of this consultation is she just started last session. It seems that she improved a lot in the hallucination. Now she's bringing up the transgender issue and how she feels really, really bad, and she wants to get some skills on how to feel a little better, that it's not the end of the world, till she gets to that process of having surgery. And I want to know how can CBT work in that, since she has a body of a woman already and she wants to be a man, she cannot get to that surgery part. How can that work?
Mm-hmm. Okay. What information do people need? Do you have any questions?
Well, I was wondering if, I'm assuming she has a psychiatrist, she's taking meds,
yeah.
So she's a psychiatrist prescribing, she's like seeing a psychiatrist on a regular basis, and mm-hmm. she brought the issue of hallucinations to the attention of the psychiatrist?
Yes, and just lately, I'm just finding out she did not tell me the truth, and even to her mom, she didn't know, so she was taking half dosage of the psychiatrist's medicine. That's why she was getting through the hallucination, because the medicine she was taking will just, like, knock her out, and she won't get up. She will just sleep all day, and she did not tell that to the psychiatrist. So I tried to reach out to the psychiatrist, but she's managing those hallucinations without the medication. You know, she would be better if she takes the food. So now we're working towards that. To get in contact with the psychiatrist so that she can get the full.
In the interest of time, let me just address a couple different issues, rather than doing more discussion. One thing that's real useful, in working with people is to figure out what problem are we dealing with here. You know, the client comes in having been diagnosed as a high-functioning autistic, ADHD, bipolar. She thinks she's schizophrenic. You know, it would be real useful to figure out, is she schizophrenic or not? Because that's going to make a big difference in treatment planning. If she's psychotic, we're going to treat things very differently than if she's not psychotic. And so I would want to find out, among other things, you know, I'd want to find out how she came to be diagnosed with the way she's been diagnosed, what makes her think she's schizophrenic. You know, pay attention to what information I've got. Do I already have enough information to figure out what's going on here? Or do I need to find more out? Do I need to request previous records? Do I need to get a second opinion, etc.? And it would be wonderful if every previous mental health professional the person had seen was wonderfully competent, if every psychiatrist in the world did their job great, etc. We live in a reality where previous diagnoses may or may not be accurate. You know, where the treating psychiatrist may or may not do a good job of thinking things through clearly. And, you know, what makes her think that she's schizophrenic?
Because of the hallucinations.
Yeah. And if you think, as a layperson, I have hallucinations, I must be schizophrenic, makes perfect sense. Now, A, schizophrenia isn't the only problem where people have hallucinations. If I've got hallucinations, this does not necessarily mean that I'm schizophrenic. I might have a variety of other problems. But does she know what's a hallucination and what isn't a hallucination?
It seems like that.
Well, I mean, she describes the experience. She's walking down the hallway and walks into a wall. Did she describe what she saw was seen before she walked into the wall?
Yeah, she saw it like a hallway.
Okay. This is not the kind of hallucination schizophrenics have. You know, visual hallucinations are not real common in schizophrenia. And when you do have visual hallucinations, it might be something moved out of the corner of my eye. Or
she gets that too, yeah.
And so, you know, when lay people are using technical terms, it's real handy to check, when she says hallucinations, what does she mean? And, you know, at least some of what she's experiencing is actually not, you know, she's fallen asleep. And she has, you know, hears a siren, she hears gibberish, etc. My bet is if we discussed it in a little more detail about what was going on, it would be what's called hypnagogic imagery. You know, as one is falling asleep, people have all sorts of strange experiences. One of the most common ones is you suddenly feel like you're falling and then you wake up suddenly. How many people here have had that? Okay, that's about 95% of us. Is this a hallucination? No. You know, this is hypnagogic imagery. Basically, the dreaming processes kick into in prematurely, and there's a whole variety of strange experiences. You know, you can see people who aren't there, hear people calling your voices, all sorts of stuff. Now, lay people and most mental health professionals have never heard of hypnagogic images. So if this happens to somebody, they're going to do their best to understand what's going on.
So that's during sleep when you.
Well, that's
sleep and
as you're falling asleep. You're not asleep yet. You're in the process of falling asleep.
Yeah, for the hearing the sirens, that one was before.
Yeah.
Sleep.
And so people are good. And when the people have a strange experience, they're going to do their best to understand what's going on. Mm. And a lot of people, it was a hallucination, and it actually may or may not be a hallucination. Sometimes they're right, sometimes wrong. I've also had a number of clients who thought it was a ghost. Mm. You know. And that's also not what's happening. And so if the person's misunderstanding what's going on, that can take them down a completely wrong path. And, you know, when she hears a siren, how does she know it's a hallucination and there isn't a siren there?
Yeah, but that's one of the things that I told her. I said, were there anyone with you in the room? I heard it. How do you know? That's what it
mm-hmm.
is.
What was her answer?
She said she didn't know. She thought it was real, but in the morning she will because. And then she said a voice mm-hmm. told her go to the highway, this and this and the interaction. And she mm-hmm. she went actually to look what is like maybe mm-hmm. yeah. maybe someone is there, but nobody was there.
Yeah. And so you know, into the first round is. You know, a good evaluation and figuring out what problem we're dealing with. You know, if I know how to sort out what's a hallucination and what isn't a hallucination, I could do that piece of work myself. If I don't, you know, one option would be talking with your psychiatrist, finding out, has he done actually inquired into this, or has he just figured, oh, she says she's having hallucinations, she must be schizophrenic, here's an antipsychotic. You know, and he may well not have stopped to think, wait, you know, it might be a good idea to assess whether she's having hallucinations or not, rather than just taking her word for it. You know, one of the possibilities, when she takes the antipsychotics at the prescribed dose, they're really sedating. That would fit with the hypothesis that she's actually not psychotic and doesn't need to be on antipsychotics. Now, that doesn't prove anything because there are plenty of people who are psychotic, but they're more sensitive than average and they need to be on a lower dose. But, you know, it sounds like we got a situation here where she's diagnosed herself as psychotic and her psychiatrist is prescribing antipsychotics without thinking about it. You know, personally, you know, I would be inclined to discuss the situation with her psychiatrist, see what I think of his explanation of things, and probably get a second opinion. Because, you know, it wouldn't surprise me at all if it turns out that she's not on the right meds. And another piece of what has me suspicious that she's may not be schizophrenic is, you know, the interventions you try are ones that are often helpful. That's why you find them recommended on the internet. But it sounds like they work better and more quickly than I would expect them to work with somebody who really is schizophrenic. And, you know, CBT can work real well with psychosis, but if the person's not psychotic, I don't want to be doing CBT for psychosis. I want to be doing CBT for whatever problem they have. A quick example on the CBT for psychosis front. I had a schizophrenic client who actually was schizophrenic and was having command hallucinations. This was a problem for him. One chunk of it is, are you taking your meds, dude? actually with him as a classic example, why wasn't he compliant with his meds? Well, when you focus on specific situations and pinpoint the automatic thoughts, his thinking was, I don't want to be crazy. Crazy people take meds. Therefore, I won't take my meds. Mm-hmm. This is not real clear thinking, but it resulted in major non-compliance problems. So what we want to take through, okay, makes perfect sense. You don't want to be psychotic. Many people who are psychotic take meds. What do you think? Is dropping your meds a good way to be not crazy? And breaking it down in manageable steps, he could explain to me, no, actually, that's a pretty dumb move. When I don't take my meds, I do a lot worse than when I do take my meds. And I could be empathic about him not liking the idea of taking meds. And I could be empathic about obnoxious side effects. And I could raise the idea, would it be a good idea to let a psychiatrist know about the obnoxious side effects in case adjusting doses, could be helpful? Oh, he hadn't thought of that. The other piece of work we did with the voices were telling him to do, I forget exactly what the voices were telling him to do. What does he think? Is it a good move to go along with the voices? Have there been times in the past when the voices told him to do certain things and he went along with it? Oh, yeah. What was the situation then? Well, he went to the bus stop to catch the bus. The voices told him that the guy at the bus stop thought he was gay and that he couldn't let that happen. So he stabbed the guy with a pocket knife and shot him with a flare pistol and ended up in the state prison for felonious assault and then ended up in North Coast after that. Does this tell him anything about whether going along with what the voices say is a good, bad, or mediocre idea? Gee, he did what the voices told him. He ended up in prison and then the psych hospital. It sounds like, going along with the voices is a good way to end up in deep shit. I try to talk in the client's vernacular. I don't remember if I worded it exactly that way, but something equivalent. What does he think if the voices tell him that he has to get even with the guy in the next room? Is it a good idea to go along with the voices, or would it be a good move to stop and think it over? Maybe consult somebody whose opinion he trusted. And, it didn't take a whole lot of guided discovery for him to register the voices, give lousy advice. Much of the time, he knows better ways to deal with stuff than the voices do. And when he doesn't know what's a good way to deal with a situation, talking with somebody whose judgment he trusts is a really good idea. Now, this isn't instead of the meds. We also want to get him taking his meds consistently because a lot of people need both antipsychotic meds and good CBT. But it can be real useful. On the how do you apply CBT with transgender issues, this is a whole specialty area. So the question is, do I want to put the time and energy into learning enough about gender issues in order to treat this effectively? Or is this something where I don't have that much time and energy, I need to help them move them on to somebody who deals with gender issues on a regular basis? And certainly one part of it is understanding the person's thoughts and feelings in different situations and helping them think it through clearly and so on. But there's a lot of specialized knowledge about gender issues and gender reassignment surgery and how you sort out whether it's a good or bad idea and so on. You know, that, you know, it takes a fair investment of time and energy to learn all that stuff. You know, so again, I want to, you know, think through, does it make sense for me to take on a new specialty area and put the time and energy into mastering it, or does it make sense to help them get connected with somebody who's already up to speed in this area? You know, one of the case examples in the text is I got referred a lady with kleptomania. And at that point in the career, I didn't know how you dealt with kleptomania in CBT. I didn't know of any CBT protocols for kleptomania. What did I do? Well, the first thing I did was get on the phone and see if anybody in Cleveland knew how to treat kleptomania. And I was ready to refer them on. It turned out there was one person I could find in Cleveland, and they were on vacation. and the lady had a court date coming up, so waiting till the person got back in a month wasn't the viable option. So I spent some time reading up on kleptomania and learning how to treat it, and it ended up working out just fine. But, you know, we need to be realistic about how much spare time and free energy we've got, and I'm not going to, you know, it's not realistic for me to try to master every specialty area. At this point, let's take a short break. Let's see. Oh, let's take a 10-minute break.